President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden are now just hours away from squaring off in their first presidential debate of election 2020. Tonight's 90-minute face-to-face encounter will take place at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, at 9 p.m. Eastern. But in a nod to social distancing, there will be no traditional handshake, and unlike most of the Democratic primary debates, there will be no opening statements. Instead, moderator and Fox News anchor Chris Wallace will launch right into questions with President Trump up first. Plenty more on the pre-debate positioning by both camps coming up, but first, here's what else has been happening around Washington today. On Capitol Hill, Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett began meeting with senators ahead of her confirmation hearing beginning October 12th. Her first stop was the office of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, arriving this morning accompanied by Vice President Mike Pence. On the other side of the Capitol today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi reportedly spoke for nearly an hour with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin about a new coronavirus relief bill. The two are expected to continue their conversations tomorrow to see if they can find a path forward. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm John McArdle. Before we get into tonight's all-important debate, a snapshot of the presidential campaign trail today, now just 35 days left until Election Day. Dr. Jill Biden, wife of Democratic nominee Joe Biden, was in northern Michigan to talk about how climate change is impacting farmers. Afterwards, she attended a voter mobilization event in Traverse City to encourage voters to vote early. Meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence spent the day on Capitol Hill with Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett, and more on that later in the program. And a quick note on the latest race ratings. The nonpartisan Cook Political Report shifted the presidential race in Ohio and Iowa today to toss-up from Lean's Republican. The Cook Report noted several recent surveys showing a tightening of the race between President Trump and Joe Biden in the Buckeye and Hawkeye states. The independent online newsletter had moved the races in both states to Lean's Republican from likely Republican back in mid-June. You can read more about the race ratings at cookpolitical.com. And before tonight's debate, new ads are being released in support of both candidates in Florida. Liberal activists have teamed up with former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg to attract black voters to Joe Biden. A $3.4 million ad campaign featuring Democratic vice presidential nominee Senator Kamala Harris is the centerpiece of the effort led by Priorities USA and Black PAC. In the spot, titled One Nation, Harris, the first black woman and Indian American to be on a major party ticket, offered a message of unity. The ad will run on both broadcast and digital media. Here's the ad.
We are at an inflection point in the history of our nation. Our United States of America is not about us versus them. It's about we, the people. We can heal our nation. It's up to us. It's up to us. Each and every one of us.
Black PAC and Priorities USA Action are responsible for the content of this advertising.
And the top outside group supporting President Trump's reelection is putting $40 million behind its own new ad, warning that Democratic nominee Joe Biden will raise taxes if he's elected president. The America First Action Super PAC will run the ad titled Day One in Pennsylvania, Florida, Wisconsin, North Carolina, and Georgia. The bulk of the money behind the ad, $18.4 million, is allocated to Pennsylvania, where polls find Biden leading by 5.7 points in the Real Clear Politics average of polling. Here's that spot.
America's economy coming back. Now, Joe Biden out with his plan.
I would shut it down.
Joe Biden today on taxes.
Guess what? If you elect me, you're not going to have your taxes are going to be raised, not cut.
Biden promising he'll raise taxes on day one.
On day one. I would shut it down. Guess what? If you elect me, I'm not going to have your taxes are going to be raised, not cut. It's on day one.
Joe Biden. The times are tough. The man is too weak.
America First Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And now to tonight's debate. The debate being held at the Sheila and Eric Sampson Pavilion run by Case Western University and the Cleveland Clinic. The Cleveland Clinic is also serving as the official health security advisor to the Commission on Presidential Debates. Tonight's moderator is Fox News Sunday host Chris Wallace. He also hosted the final debate in 2016 between then Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, then Republican nominee Donald Trump. Before the debate today, there was a bit of drama. The Trump campaign released the following statement regarding the debate rules. This from Communications Director Tim Murtaugh. Quote, Joe Biden's handler several days ago agreed to a pre-debate inspection for electronic earpieces, but today abruptly reversed themselves and declined. Biden handlers have asked for multiple breaks during the debate, which President Trump doesn't need, so we have rejected that request. The Biden team is looking for any safety net they can find in the hours leading to the debate, end quote. In response, Kate Bedingfield, communications director and deputy campaign manager for the Biden campaign, said on a call with reporters, quote, of course he's not wearing an earpiece and we never asked for a break. She also told reporters that the Biden campaign would have three guests tonight, an Arizona woman who spoke at the Democratic convention about her father who died of COVID-19, an Ohio small business owner, and another Ohioan and member of the Steelworkers Union. Some of President Trump's guests include most of his family, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and UFC fighter Colby Covington. With more now on the history of debates and what can be learned from them and what to expect tonight, we turn to Mitchell McKinney, director of the University of Missouri's Political Communications Institute. He spoke on this morning's Washington Journal program, and he was asked what impact debates make on an election.
Well, what we've learned over time is that the vast majority of those tuning in tonight, and we expect a large audience, we've seen that with debates, even increase in their viewership, where a lot of the political campaigning, the party conventions, other forms of political communication has waned over the past several years. Not so with debates. We actually set a record 4 years ago, the first debate, and the first debate in a series typically draws the largest crowd. But that first debate was almost 82 million viewers, the all-time record. Now, most of those viewers tuning in, what we've learned, as high as 90%+ of those viewers are there to cheer on their candidate, to cheer on and to root for the candidate that they already are committed to. However, there is typically a small slice of viewers, of voters, who haven't been following the race very closely, who are uncommitted. And what we found with that small slice, they use the debate to make a candidate choice, a vote commitment. Now, that number typically in our studies has been anywhere from 2 to 3, 4%, never more than 5%. And yet, in terms of a race where the dynamics are such, particularly in battleground states, that slice of debate viewership can make a difference. So certainly important first debate. We expect high viewership and can be consequential, I think, in the outcome of the election.
So you've probably heard critics of debates overall and their necessity. One of them is the New York Times, Charles Blow. He had a piece yesterday, and in part he wrote this. Indeed, we don't need a debate. What will it really tell us that we don't already know? What will it truly reveal? The debate will show us how candidates converse and clash. It will show us how they respond when attacked and how they recover or not when bruised. But none of this at this late date should be a determinant of how one votes.
Well, certainly, and I think it is true for many of those folks, pundits, media, campaign operatives, others, even a great deal of citizenry, and a lot of your callers are following politics very closely. But yet again, with the reach of debates, when we see that 80+ million, they have the potential, and they do reach those individuals that haven't been following politics, haven't been following the campaign so closely. And so for those individuals, unlike many others, who will be hearing a lot of the same issue positions, a lot of the same arguments that candidates have been making on the stump, We expect that in debate, but for some voters, this is the time for them to size up the candidates, the only time in the campaign that we see them together face to face. And in terms of what voters take away from the debates, our research shows that this is the moment that they point to. Source of information, what they regard as the most useful. And I think that's attributed to the fact that we see the debate, and it is the case that this is the form of campaign communication that is least controlled by the candidates. Unlike their ads, unlike their rallies, their stump speeches, their party conventions that are produced by the parties, the candidates are there without notes, without teleprompter, without their aides. Again, again, not knowing the specific questions that will be put to them. And because of that, I think that's the reason that voters point to the debate message. And when they see the candidates meet into debate, as a reliable form of communication, where that they feel that they're getting the true, if you will, or what we hear, the authentic candidate. And so for all of those reasons, although, again, we will be hearing and throughout the series of the three debates, we will likely hear some of the same arguments, some of the same lines that we've heard from the candidates, particularly those following politics very closely. But for other voters, this is new information, and this is information that we found that they claim is very useful to them.
Mitchell McKinney, do debates end up being make or break moments typically for the candidates involved?
You know, Pedro, we certainly point back to some of those memorable moments in debates that then are played over and over again that can have, I think, a very powerful impact on our impressions of the candidates. In terms of the make or break, we have had debate series from the very beginning, for example, in 1960, a very close election. And certainly Richard Nixon claimed that his performance that he felt in those first Kennedy-Nixon debates just didn't match up to the performance of John Kennedy. As a matter of fact, that was one of the main reasons why we went on debates went on hiatus for a bit. Richard Nixon was a candidate in 68 and 72 and refused to debate. Now, we finally had debates resume again in 1976. There's another debate series where some blunders by Gerald Ford in the 1976 debate, I think, influenced the perception of his knowledge and performance as president. We can look at other moments, too, I think, and make some assessments. And again, as I said earlier, if the dynamics of the race are such, and that is typically, is the race close enough going into the debate series? Are there enough undecided voters? And particularly if we drill down and we look at some of those battleground states where we know the race is won or lost, are there enough undecided voters then that may be influenced by the debate that could make have an outcome? And so there are a number of those historic moments that we point to and claim that they were influential in the eventual outcome of the race.
That was Mitchell McKinney, director of the Political Communications Institute at the University of Missouri. You can find the entire interview on our website at cspan.org. And while we're hours from the actual debate, news today about where the candidates will be going in the days to come. According to the Washington Post, Joe Biden plans to leave the Cleveland presidential debate via one of his favorite modes of transportation, a train. The Biden Build Back Better train tour departs from Cleveland tomorrow and will make five stops, including in Alliance, Ohio, in Pittsburgh, in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, and Latrobe, Pennsylvania, ending in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. President Trump will head to Jacksonville, Florida on Thursday and hold a rally for his Great America Comeback event that day. You're listening to Washington Today. On Capitol Hill today, Supreme Court nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett met with Republican senators. This comes before her confirmation hearing, scheduled to begin Monday, October the 12th. Barrett's scheduled meetings on Tuesday were all with Republicans. She started her day meeting with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Vice President Mike Pence. In the afternoon, she met with other key Republican senators on the Judiciary Committee, that panel overseeing the nomination, including Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, and Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, who chairs that panel. Instead of meeting in each senator's office, lawmakers are meeting individually with Barrett in a larger room in the Capitol to account for COVID-19 social distancing. After his meeting with her, McConnell, joined by Barrett and officials from the White House, offered brief remarks about starting the process.
Well, we're pleased today to welcome Judge Barrett to begin the process of advising consent in the Senate. As you know, she'll be visiting with members who are interested in talking to her during the course of the next few days. And we're glad to have her here and glad to get the process started.
Well, on behalf of President Donald Trump, I want to thank the Senate Majority Leader and your colleagues in the Senate. who have committed to meet with an extraordinary American. In Judge Amy Coney Barrett, we have someone of great character, of great intellect, who has a judicial philosophy that will uphold the Constitution of the United States. President Trump discharged his duty under Article 2 to nominate Judge Barrett to the vacancy on the Supreme Court of the United States. And now we look forward, our entire team leader, working with you, Republicans in the Senate, and we hope Democrats in the Senate as well, as you discharge your duty to advise and consent. We truly do believe that Judge Barrett represents the best of America personally, in terms of her great intellect, her great background, and we have every confidence that as the American people learn more about Judge Amy Coney Barrett, they will be as inspired as President Trump was when he made her nomination. But we believe the Senate has an opportunity leader for a fair and respectful consideration, a hearing. We urge our Democrat colleagues in the Senate to take the opportunity to meet with Judge Barrett, and as the hearing goes forward, to provide the kind of respectful hearing that the American people expect. We look forward to a vote in the Senate in the near future to fill the seat on the Supreme Court of the United States, because the American people deserve a justice like Judge Amy Coney Barrett, and the American people deserve 9 justices on the Supreme Court of the United States. So thank you, Leader, for the warm welcome today, and we look forward to working with you.
Leader McConnell, if Judge Coney Barrett is confirmed, should she recuse herself from any election-related cases?
All right, folks, let's go. Thank you. Let's go.
That was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, joined by Vice President Mike Pence and Circuit Court Judge Amy Coney Barrett. And this is Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
Well, it is a terrific pleasure to have the chance to sit down and visit with Judge Barrett. I have to say, she brings to this nomination impeccable credentials. She graduated number one in her class from Notre Dame Law School. She clerked for the great Justice Antonin Scalia. She's been a law professor at Notre Dame for 20 years. She's one of the most respected federal appellate judges in the country. And somehow she manages to do all that while being a mom to 7 kids, which I have to admit, I don't know how to even do the latter, much less do everything else that Judge Barrett manages to do at the same time. I think President Trump made a terrific selection in nominating Judge Barrett. This is why the American people elected President Trump. In 2016, there was a sharply differing vision for the kinds of justices that would be appointed to the court. Hillary Clinton promised to nominate judicial activists who would legislate from the bench. She promised to nominate justices who were committed to overturning fundamental protections on things like the Second Amendment, things like free speech. And Donald Trump presented a very different vision for what Supreme Court justices and judges should do. President Trump promised to nominate judges in the mold of Scalia and Thomas, judges who would be faithful to the Constitution, who would follow the text of the Constitution, and who would protect the Bill of Rights, protect our fundamental liberties, free speech, religious liberties, the fundamental rights that all Americans enjoy. I think the president's decision to nominate Judge Barrett may well have been the most important decision of his presidency. And in making this nomination, the president was fulfilling the promise he made to the American people. Likewise, I expect that the Senate will confirm Judge Barrett and do so by the end of the month. And when the Senate does so, we will be honoring the promise we made to the American people.
Judge Barrett does not have any meetings currently scheduled with Democrats, and several Democratic senators say that they will not meet with her. Asked Monday if she would meet with Barrett, the Democratic Party's vice presidential nominee, Senator Kamala Harris, told reporters, quote, "I'm sure that's going to happen. We'll see how it works out. I haven't made a plan one way or another," end quote. You're listening to Washington Today. Back on the House side, Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin spoke Tuesday morning after Democrats unveiled a coronavirus stimulus plan designed to restart progress toward a relief deal. Democrats released the $2.2 trillion legislation this week after passing a $3.4 trillion proposal back in May. The Trump administration has offered to inject $1.3 trillion more in their efforts to boost the economy and healthcare systems during the pandemic. Speaker Pelosi and Secretary Mnuchin spoke for 50 minutes this morning and, quote, went over the provisions of the latest proposal, the speaker's spokesman Drew Hamill said. While the pair agreed to talk again on Wednesday, it's unclear if they moved any closer to a compromise. Here's Speaker Pelosi earlier today on MSNBC.
Well, I'm always optimistic, and I thank you for observing at the start of this part of your show that 1 million people have lost their lives to this virus. That's a cause for grave concern and sadness for the world, and certainly for us in the United States, with the large number over 200,000 in our country alone. So we must take action to crush the virus. And we must do so in a way that reduces the disparities that you pointed out for Black and Hispanic young people, or just Black and Hispanic people who are suffering in an undue way with the impact of this virus. So in our legislation, our important goal is to crush the virus so that children, that we can open our economy, children can go to school in a much safer way, to protect our heroes and to put money in the pockets of the American people. There were three main pillars of the HEROES Act, and they continue to be three main pillars of our reduced package. Now, when we reduced it, we didn't take out priorities. We just reduced the timeline as to how long those benefits would last. We hope and pray for a vaccine that would, of course, reduce the necessity for us to go on for a longer period of time. But if we need to, we will. Our conversation was a positive one. We'll get back together tomorrow to see how we can find common ground on how we, again, help state and local government play the role that it does. They're our heroes.
So the conversation is ongoing, and it's going to continue tomorrow. Yes. The price tag of this new plan, as I understand it, about $1.2 trillion, less than that relief package that came out of the House back in May. When might the House vote on this current package? And how optimistic are you that the upper chamber will actually take it up?
Well, we're in a negotiation, and hopefully we will come to a bipartisan agreement that will remove all doubt that the legislation will pass and be signed by the president. That's my goal, that we come to agreement so that we can put money in the pockets of the American people, so we can stop what's happening to the airlines. We only have a couple of days before many people will lose their jobs who are employed by airlines. That's a date certain, September 30th.
That was Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi earlier today. Back on Capitol Hill, the House Oversight Committee held a hearing looking at white supremacy and police departments. According to an article posted today at The Intercept, quote, an FBI threat assessment report was released by Congressman Jamie Raskin, chair of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Subcommittee, ahead of that hearing about the white supremacist infiltration of local police departments. The article says a heavily redacted version of the 2006 document had previously been published, one of a handful of documents revealing federal officials' growing concern with white supremacists. The unredacted version of the first document sheds further light on the FBI's concerns as early as 2006 about, quote, self-initiated efforts by individuals, particularly among those already within law enforcement ranks, to volunteer their professional resources to white supremacist causes with which they sympathize, end quote. You can find the entire article at TheIntercept.com. Here's Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, questioning Arizona Sheriff of Pima County, Mark Napier.
One of the things that concerns me, you know, you talk about your son, and I'm, you know, of course, concerned about a lot of things when it comes to policing in my community. But I want to take a close look at something that happened within your district. Last November, one of your officers was caught on camera tackling a black teen in foster care who lives without arms or legs, Sheriff. Okay? He was tackled by an officer under your leadership. He was also seen abusing another black teen who was merely filming the incident. That officer was not charged. So I'm wondering if that is the case of why you haven't been able to diversify your work for your team, or, you know, some of the concerns there. So I truly believe, you know, curious on your end, what kind of treatment did that officer get? Was he held accountable?
Well, first, we presented that as we should. We put the officer on immediate leave and presented that matter to the county attorney's office, who made the decision to decline criminal charges. That was not
so he was never charged, correct?
That was a basis.
Do you think that is also leading to people not wanting to work for a police force that is, you know, constantly involved in criminal activity and assault of innocent civilians?
Well, it was deemed not to be criminal activity, ma'am, because the attorney's office made that decision. I did not make that decision.
Oh, I know. Sheriff, the system is broken, and I know you don't want to face the fact that you and your son are in a system right now that is broken, and I know that you're deterring away from talking about it in that way.
That was Sheriff Mark Napier earlier today. In a report published last month by the Brennan Center for Justice, former FBI agent Mike German detailed law enforcement agencies' longstanding failure to respond to some officers' associations with white supremacist and militant groups, as well as the history of law enforcement involvement in white supremacist violence. Since 2000, law enforcement officials with alleged connections to white supremacist groups have been exposed in more than a dozen states, while hundreds of federal, state, and local law enforcement officials have been caught expressing racist or sexist views on social media, quote, which demonstrates that overt bias is far too common, end quote, German noting in his report. Also speaking at the hearing was Heather Taylor, a former police officer in St. Louis and president of the Ethical Society of Police in St. Louis.
I want to provide my perspective by telling a true story. For nearly 7 years, I have repeatedly reported an officer for his racism. I learned this officer had a penchant for making racist statements about black people on social media. He once stated, "Black people are pathetic." He also cheered a black man being shot in the head, posting, "You can take him out of the ghetto, but you can't take the ghetto out of him." A black woman accused him of saying only prostitutes and drug dealers own Bentleys. Another time, he made a racist statement about black people and welfare. This officer was also reported for racial profiling by a citizen. He's also a field training officer, training hundreds of officers within our police department. He's never been fired for these statements and these complaints, despite people like myself, who's a sworn officer, and citizens making these complaints. These statements were not the worst of his actions. This officer and other officers killed a black man under questionable circumstances in 2012. I was a scene investigator on that case. That case haunts me to this day. He used a banned chokehold. Another officer tased this man six times. The officer violated numerous policies. A witness said that one of the officers used the N-word during this incident. Others stated the victim resisted arrest. The use of the N-word, all witness statements relayed to me, all questionable actions by the officers were placed in a police report, an official document. The report was turned over to the Internal Affairs Division for review for criminal charges or discipline. I was told the officers were returned to full duty. No charges were filed. Just couldn't believe it. So I delivered a copy of the police report to the Circuit Attorney's Office in 2013, months after the case was finally done. I just couldn't believe that there were no charges. There was nothing. To this day, I don't know if a grand jury ever reviewed the case for any form of charges. I don't know the discipline of that case.
That was Heather Taylor earlier today before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. You can find the entire program at our website at cspan.org. Finally today, a portion of our conversation with Newt Minow, who was instrumental in starting the tradition of debates back in 1960 with then-Vice President Richard Nixon, then-Senator John F. Kennedy. C-SPAN's Steve Scully asked Minow what he would change about the debates being held this year.
If you could make any changes in terms of how presidential candidates run for office, whether it means more debates or more access to journalists asking questions, more town meetings, what would Newt Minow change, if anything?
I would change everything. I would change so we went to a system, as is true in most other countries, where candidates cannot purchase time. The time is allocated as a public service by broadcasters, and that we would take a lot of the money out of politics. That's the first thing I would do. And I would have more debates rather than less.
That was Newt Minow, former chair of the FCC and a guest on C-SPAN's The Weekly podcast. You can find that entire episode wherever you listen to podcasts. Finally, remember tonight you can watch or listen to the entire presidential debate. Our coverage begins at 8 p.m. Eastern, and we'll be taking your calls after the program. I'm John McArdle. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Enjoy the debate.